USS Enterprise was bound for Midway with her two sister ships, Yorktown operating under the command of Admiral Fletcher, and Enterprise herself plus Hornet under Admiral Spruance, since Admiral Halsey was too ill to continue in command for the moment. Her air group was slightly different to that which had started the war. She still had Air Group 6 aboard, but the balance of aircraft had changed. VB6 and VS6 still had 18 Dauntless apiece, but VT6 had been reduced to 14 Devastators, and VF6, partially thanks to the extra space from the missing torpedo bombers, and partially thanks to the F4F4's folding wings, was now up to 27 aircraft. In the hangars, crewmen were putting the final touches on a revised paint scheme. The red dot, which had been at the centre of each roundel, was to be whited out, leaving just a white star on a dark blue circle. This had been ordered after the Battle of Coral Sea to avoid confusion with Japanese aircraft, since the muted blues and whites that made up most of the aircraft's paint scheme could diffuse into the background and leave a general aircraft-looking shape, but the bright red dots were very distinctive, even if the aircraft shape itself might not be. And of course, since all Japanese aircraft proudly carried large red circles as their roundels, it could lead to confusion, which was further not helped by the fact that everybody was using radial engine aircraft, and friendly fire was something they really wanted to avoid. Although the odds going into this action seemed to be against the US on paper, as the Japanese were bringing four large veteran carriers versus two veteran US ones and a newbie, since Hornet's main flying activity up to this point had been the Doolittle raid, there were a number of advantages in the US favour. Thanks to intelligence efforts, the US Navy knew the approximate strength of the enemy and where they were headed. The Imperial Japanese Navy, meanwhile, wasn't sure exactly how many carriers the US even still had, since they thought that Yorktown had been sunk, let alone where they were. The US formation was also carrying more aircraft per carrier. This was partially a legacy of the Imperial Japanese Navy's slow turnover of new pilots. The relatively small individual air group losses from Pearl Harbor, the various offensives in Southeast Asia, and Operation Sea would have been fairly easily made good on US ships. Indeed, even Enterprise's much-abused VS-6 was back up to full strength for this battle. But on the Japanese ships, although some replacements had arrived, the overall losses had accumulated faster than new pilots and particularly new aircrew for the larger aircraft could be sent out. Akagi, for example, was down by 9 B-5N Kates and only up by 3 A-6M-0s compared to her air group at Pearl Harbor. Kaga was down 4 D-3A Vals, and the story went on with Hiryu and Soryu, which, when you coupled that with the fact that typically Japanese carriers carried three squadrons of 18 aircraft apiece, except for Onkaga, which carried a few more, while the US had an additional scouting squadron for four squadrons in total, although Japanese carriers might include an additional flight of 4 to 6 aircraft here or there, it meant that the total aircraft odds weren't actually that bad when you added everything up. And then there was Midway itself. There were a number of strike, reconnaissance, and fighter aircraft based there, which added to overall US numbers and actually tipped total numbers in the US's favour. And if nothing else, Midway was an unsinkable reconnaissance platform that could find and spot the Japanese without needing to reveal the direction or even existence of the US carrier formations. Thanks to the combined intelligence efforts, the US expected the Japanese to hit Midway on June the 4th, which meant that on June the 3rd, Enterprise's hangar was a hive of activity as every gun and weapons release system was checked and rechecked, and some pilots were even seen wandering around their aircraft with pots of wax, applying wax coatings by hand to any part of the aircraft that was not already gleaming or protruded in some way, just in case it might give them an extra knot or two of speed. Something that's often not appreciated when it comes to these carrier battles is that although the strikes couldn't be launched until at least dawn, because they had to fly during daylight hours, the pilots and air crews had to get up many hours before then, having to be roused from bed, then change into their flight gear, eat, be briefed on the mission, get to their aircraft, have the aircraft prepped, and have the aircraft moved onto the flight deck. This took hours, with many of Enterprise's air group thus being drummed out of bed in the small hours of the morning, at 03:30 to be precise. No wonder that caffeine was considered as important as bullets and fuel aboard a carrier. In these pre-dawn hours, the final tactics for the air groups were arranged. One decision would end up having a significant impact on the forthcoming missions. At Coral Sea, Yorktown and Lexington had seen their torpedo bombers get off relatively unscathed, but the dive bombers had been, relatively speaking, quite badly hit by enemy combat air patrols. Based on this, as well as the logic that it was far quicker and easier to dive than it was to climb thousands of feet, it was decided that the fighters assigned to escort duty would stay high with the dive bombers. If the torpedo bombers then found they needed help down at sea level, they would have to call it in and the fighters would make best speed to assist, although a special code phrase was arranged in order to allow expedient fighter support. Once again, the VB6 Dauntlesses carried their 1,000-pound bombs while the VS6 aircraft carried 500-pounders, partly allowing for more range, and partly because VS6 was lined up at the very front of the flight deck and they would have the shortest takeoff run. Although a number of VS6 aircraft were also spotted with 100-pounder bombs on the wings, some of which were incendiary. Just before 0700, word finally came in that Midway-based reconnaissance aircraft had spotted some of the Japanese carriers, and Enterprise began to accelerate into the wind as Yorktown was recovering her morning search aircraft and Enterprise and Hornet had been allowed to go off and do their own thing to a certain degree. Thanks to the direction of the prevailing wind, Enterprise headed southeast, and at 0706, the first aircraft of her strike package began to rumble off the deck. But at this stage in the war, US carrier strike doctrine lagged quite far behind their opponents. Japanese carriers would launch smaller groups of mixed aircraft quite quickly. These would then form up with the aircraft from other carriers to form a large strike wave that could then head off pretty rapidly. US doctrine, meanwhile, still was a bit of a holdover from the interwar period where individual carriers operated as their own self-contained group. And this called for each carrier to launch its entire air group before they headed off. In this case, it meant that at around 0745, despite being almost 3/4 of an hour since the first aircraft had left the deck, while most of both Dauntless squadrons were airborne, the deck crew were now having to scramble to position the torpedo bombers and the dozen or so fighters assigned to escort on the freshly vacated aft flight deck. Clearly, it was going to take quite a while, and the fuel of the first Dauntlesses was already being eaten into quite significantly. Spruance, realising that time really was of the essence, ordered the Dauntlesses to head off on their own, and the other aircraft would just have to catch up as and when they could. Various mechanical issues and the like, causing some aircraft to fail to launch or have to head back to the carrier, meant that eventually a total of 31 dive bombers would head off roughly southwest, expecting a flight of around an hour to an hour and a half. In the confusion and the rush, when the 10 escort Wildcats eventually managed to get airborne, they couldn't actually find the dive bombers, or indeed Enterprise's own torpedo bombers. Instead, they spotted what they thought was VT-6 and locked in for top cover of these aircraft, but it turned out they were actually following a slightly confused VT-8, the Devastators from Hornet. As various air groups and squadrons were responsible for setting their own courses to best try and find the enemy carriers, VF-6's fighters actually turned out to be the first to arrive over the Japanese fleet. But, having in the interim managed to lose contact with pretty much everyone else, and under fairly strict radio silence orders, there wasn't much they could do but orbit for a while before their fuel levels would eventually force them to return to base. Below, Hornet's Devastators actually showed up, but since they didn't know the specific code phrase to summon VF-6's fighters, and VF-6 was still on the lookout for their own dive bombers, the Enterprise fighters eventually headed back for home when their fuel tanks began to run low, without engaging any Japanese aircraft. But next up for Enterprise's air group was VT-6. They spotted pools of smoke on the horizon and headed after them. They assumed, correctly, that these pools of smoke were the funnel exhausts of the Japanese fleet. Unfortunately, they happened to arrive at the worst possible time and position. As mentioned, VT-8 from Hornet had already started attacking at around 0920, which meant that when VT-6 showed up 20 minutes later, not only were the Japanese forces on full alert, with many combat air patrol fighters having come down to low altitude, but a number of fighters that had been on hot standby on the flight decks were by this point just about settling into their positions after having been freshly launched. VT-6 spotted and tried to go after Kaga, but she turned away from them at speed, forcing a long, drawn-out tail chase which drew the VT-6 aircraft over the anti-aircraft guns and combat air patrol sweeps of pretty much the entire Kido Butai. By the time the last of their Mark 13 torpedoes splashed rather ineffectively into the water, 9 out of the 13 TBDs had been shot down. Another went down into the sea shortly thereafter due to accumulated damage, and of the 4 remaining, another would end up being shoved over the side soon after landing, having been judged more of a flying colander than a torpedo strike aircraft. In exchange for these catastrophic losses, VT-6 had been unable to hit anything except for one rather overconfident Zero, which was seen heading into the sea after it came too close to a tail gunner. Partly this had been down to loss of aircraft, but they had managed to get almost half a dozen torpedoes into the water near Kaga. But while the Mark 13 didn't have anywhere near the same level of issues as the Mark 14, at this stage in the war, it was still a very unreliable weapon and had failed to do anything to the Japanese carrier. It seemed that VB-6 and VS-6 weren't going to have much better luck. They were almost 3 hours into their flight and had seen nothing. Fuel was running low, and Wade McCluskey, who was leading the dive bombers, decided he was going to make one final roll of the dice and extend their search just a little bit longer, even though he knew that this was at the risk of some of his aircraft having to ditch through lack of fuel on the way home. He led the aircraft northwest, and then, finally, the luck of Enterprise's aircraft changed. Far below was the wake of a single warship moving at speed. In this area, it could only be a Japanese vessel. It was, in fact, the destroyer Arashi, which was rushing to rejoin the Kido Butai after a failed attempt to sink the submarine USS Nautilus. McCluskey decided that the destroyer was most likely heading to the same place that he wanted to be, albeit for somewhat different reasons, and using the destroyer's wake like a gigantic white arrow, he aimed the formation in that direction. Soon enough, he was rewarded with the sight of the Kido Butai unfolding below him. It was just after 10:00, and by sheer luck, good for Enterprise's dive bombers, but not so good for Yorktown's torpedo bombers, VT-3 had now shown up, just minutes earlier. This led the Japanese Combat Air Patrol down to the deck once again, and although VT-3 paid dearly for providing the unintentional distraction, after having savaged no less than 3 separate torpedo bomber squadrons, a number of the Japanese fighters now had to return to their carriers to rearm and refuel. Also aboard the Kido Butai's carriers, in the hangars, much of their strike complement was in the process of arming, or in many cases rearming, aircraft for an anti-shipping strike, since in the interim, Japanese scouts had spotted some of the US carriers. This was the point at which US luck truly turned, but even as Enterprise's air group began to position themselves for their dives, by sheer coincidence, VB-3 from Yorktown also showed up, their search pattern having led them in a completely different direction, but arriving at almost the same time. By accident, although the intention had been to split Enterprise's bombers between two carriers, almost all of them headed for Kaga. Midway through this process, Lieutenant Dick Best realized the mistake, and he took himself and his section after Akagi. Yorktown's pilots went after Soryu, and suddenly the Japanese fleet found itself under attack, with a reduced and mostly out-of-place combat air patrol having not seen the dive bombers coming. Only last-minute anti-aircraft fire could meaningfully try and stop the dive bombers, and it turned out that this was nowhere near enough. While Yorktown's pilots repeatedly hit the smaller Soryu, most of Enterprise's air group smashed Kaga again and again, leaving her ablaze from stem to stern. Best and his two wingmen went after Akagi. They landed just a single hit, most likely from Best's aircraft, but the big 1,000-pounder smashed through the flight deck and exploded in a hangar that was full of fueled and armed aircraft. Although she would take somewhat longer to die, Akagi had joined Kaga and Soryu on the list of doomed towering infernos. Low on fuel, and with the remaining combat air patrol Zeros angrily chasing them, Enterprise's dauntless pilots made for home as quickly as they could, given their limited fuel reserves. As they went that way, they spotted, and were then also attacked by, a counterstrike that had been launched from the one intact Japanese carrier, Hiryu, whose escorting Zeros couldn't help but take the bait of a bunch of seemingly helpless Dauntlesses. But as the Dauntlesses forged on trying to find their home ship, more and more aircraft were falling out of formation simply because their fuel was giving out. A lucky few would manage to land near friendly ships. Two others found Yorktown and landed aboard her, but others just vanished into the vast expanses of the Pacific. The final bill from this first flight operation of the battle was high. 10 of the Devastators were gone, one Wildcat had ditched, although the pilot was recovered, and no less than 18 of the Dauntlesses had failed to return, although 6 pilots and 5 gunners had been rescued from ditched aircraft. With that said, much of the lost dive bomber strength turned out to be made up by aircraft from Yorktown. As Hiryu's counterstrike was inbound, they diverted from their mothership, and over a dozen of them had made Enterprise their temporary home. While the strike pilots were resting, and in some cases receiving medical attention, their aircraft were being refueled and rearmed, or else taken down for repairs. A few were chucked over the side as completely irreparable. But the battle wasn't over. Everyone knew Hiryu was still active, and those who were on Enterprise's flight deck and bridge were distant witnesses to Yorktown's struggle against the attacking Japanese aircraft. A few of VF-6's Wildcats managed to head over to help defend her, but it was to no avail. Yorktown took several bomb and torpedo hits and was left dead in the water as her damage control crews scrambled to repair her. Fletcher released Spruance fully to continue the fight, and soon Enterprise was able to muster 2 dozen Dauntlesses for another assault. After one of Yorktown's scout aircraft confirmed Hiryu's location, the scratch force headed out, once again catching the Japanese carrier largely unawares. This time, though, the combat air patrol was in a slightly better position to intercept, and the 13 Zeros, a mixed force themselves, did their best to try and keep astern of the dive bombers as they began heading down. Hiryu also contributed her best in evasive manoeuvres, which actually caused many of the initial attacks to miss. A contingent of Yorktown aircraft, which had initially been directed at Harana, diverted to try and assist, although they ended up largely getting in the way of the latter part of Enterprise's strike. 2 bombers from Yorktown and 1 from Enterprise would fall to the Zero's guns, and Best found himself forced to break off his dive in the confusion of the arrival of Yorktown's dive bombers. He reformed along with some other pilots and tried again. Between his efforts and those of the late arriving Yorktown pilots, Hiryu was finally hit, and repeatedly. With a much shorter journey back, the Dauntlesses headed for home while the Japanese Zero pilots were left to try and work out what to do now that there were no flight decks for them to return to. The Dauntlesses therefore made it back to Enterprise without further incident, and the aircrew were quickly debriefed and bundled off to bed. This stage of the battle was over, but who knew what the next day would bring? Unfortunately for Dick Best, this was to be his last flight. Although landing the fatal blow on Akagi, and one of the fatal strikes on Hiryu, his oxygen system turned out to have malfunctioned during his first flight, leaving him breathing in caustic soda fumes. These alone did incredible damage to his lungs, leaving him coughing up blood overnight. This would also reactivate a latent tuberculosis infection, and between the two, it left him in hospital for the better part of a year, almost two, and then eventually facing medical retirement, much to his disappointment. But, on the other hand, the man who'd killed two Japanese carriers turned out to live to see the 21st century, so someone at the hospital must have done a rather good job of patching him up. June 5th was almost anticlimactic. Spruance was being very cautious, and a strike was only launched in the late afternoon when intelligence was sent from Hawaii indicating that one or possibly more Japanese carriers were still afloat, if badly damaged, and trying to limp home. Spruance's caution was warranted. If he'd headed west to try and intercept the Japanese overnight, he would have run into a number of Japanese heavy surface units. But nonetheless, now the pilots were being briefed for yet another mission. The chief of staff that Spruance had inherited from Halsey, one Captain Browning, insisted that the strike aircraft be loaded with 1,000-pound bombs. But the various squadron leaders were extremely aware that they'd actually lost more Dauntlesses to running out of fuel than enemy fire the previous day, and they knew that at the extended range they were being asked to fly, such a payload would leave them without any fuel for their return trip. Even though he was technically out of action, having been shot through the shoulder by a Japanese aircraft the previous day, Wade McCluskey hauled himself out of sick bay and, along with the other senior airmen, headed for the ship's island, picking up the Enterprise's captain, Murray, along the way. Collectively, they then launched into a furious argument with Browning. Finding Murray turned out to be a pretty good idea because he was of equal rank to Browning and so could argue with him without the latter being able to pull rank and shut down the discussion. Spruance, who was party to the shouting, listened and decided that ultimately the pilots probably knew best, ordering the strike to carry the lighter and less drag-inducing 500-pound bombs. Browning stormed off and locked himself in his cabin in a temper, and the strike flew from the flight decks. It turned out the argument was just as well. The intelligence reports were wrong, and the only thing that the strike aircraft found was the destroyer Tanikaze, who evaded all attempts to bomb her. VS-6 would lose an aircraft to her anti-aircraft fire, and another would ditch due to low fuel, but managed to fetch up next to a friendly destroyer, so the aircraft's crew were rescued. Most of the other aircraft landed on fumes. It was a lucky escape. If they'd been forced to take off with 1,000-pounders, pretty much all of Enterprise's remaining dive bombers probably would have gone down at sea. For what? Going after a destroyer that managed to evade them anyway? However, the strike had been launched so late in the day that, although they managed to make it back, the aircraft returned in the hours of darkness. This led to a little bit of amusement, as one of Enterprise's air group mistook Hornet for her home ship and landed aboard her, and five of Hornet's aircraft landed on Enterprise. This now meant that Enterprise was carrying substantial representatives of all three carriers' dive bomber units, and it actually briefly caused a panic when the flight crew checked their roster and realised they'd landed more aircraft than they'd sent out, which prompted a short but energetic search of all the landed aircraft to see if they had any Japanese infiltrators aboard. Although that died down pretty quickly when the searchers recognised serial codes from Hornet's air group on their tails. June 6th would be the final chapter of the Battle of Midway. A combined wave of 18 scout aircraft found another Japanese force. The lucky aircraft in question being a VB-8 Dauntless from Hornet, but one which had taken off from Enterprise, as its pilot had been one of the confused ones from the nights before. Initially, the radioed contact report indicated at least one carrier was present, and although Spruance was pretty sure he'd gotten all the Kido Butai flat tops by this point, you couldn't take any risks, and soon every single aircraft Enterprise could muster was in the air. 31 Dauntlesses from every squadron in the fleet, a dozen Wildcats for escort and strafing runs, and even the last three Devastators, making an extremely brave effort to try and avenge their comrades. En route, the contact information was updated from a carrier to a battleship, which made a little bit more sense, and then the torpedo bombers became separated and got themselves lost. When the dive bombers and fighters arrived over their contact, they found that the target was actually the heavy cruisers Megami and Mikuma, along with some destroyers. The two cruisers had collided the previous night and were limping along home. Mikuma caught most of the attention and was duly sunk in a hail of bombs, with the Devastators eventually showing up just as the dive bombers were in the middle of dropping their payloads. And so, rather than interfere, the trio of torpedo bombers instead circled the Japanese formation, occasionally ducking in to draw anti-aircraft fire away from the dive bombers. But wisely, they otherwise stayed well clear. Of course, while all this was going on, a Japanese submarine found and would finish off poor old Yorktown with torpedoes. And with that, the battle was finally over, and it was time to tally the bill. In total, the ship had lost 31 aircraft shot down or ditched into the ocean. This consisted of a single fighter, 20 Dauntlesses, and 10 Devastators. And this didn't include aircraft that made it back onto the flight deck but were considered completely beyond all hope of repair. 24 pilots and 25 gunners were listed as either confirmed dead or missing. 7 pilots from each Dauntless squadron, 7 gunners from VS6 and 8 gunners from VB6, plus 10 pilots and their gunners from VT6. Additionally, 2 sets of aircrew from VB3 and 1 set from VS5, both from Yorktown, had been lost in action after taking off from Enterprise's deck. Some of these figures would be slightly revised over time. VT6 and VB6 would both get some men back over the next few weeks, as a total of 4 men, 2 from each unit, who'd gone down in sight of the Japanese fleet, would eventually be found and recovered by various efforts, mostly recon aircraft from Midway. However, not all of those who had been lost had quick ends. 1 Dauntless, piloted by Ensign Frank O'Flaherty, with his gunner being Bruno Guido, the man who'd shot up the incoming Japanese twin-engine bomber and had his aircraft cut in half for his trouble earlier in the year, were pulled out of the water by the destroyer Makegumo. They were then interrogated by torture, and then, after the crew refused orders to execute them, they had weights tied to their legs the following night before being thrown over the side on the captain's orders. This would not, however, be discovered until post-war investigations uncovered the truth. The commanding officer of the destroyer would have been executed for this war crime, except that by that point he had himself been killed in action. Given the date recorded of his death, the 17th of February 1944, this probably occurred during Operation Hailstone, the overwhelming US strike on Truk. The admiral who had sent the orders over to Makegumo ordering the execution of the men was likewise killed during the course of the war. Captain Murray submitted an overall report on the strengths and weaknesses of the ship and air group in action as he saw them, the final section of which I will now quote. Summary. The following observations incident to the foregoing operations are submitted. A. Contact reports. Numerous contact reports initiated from the forces at Midway had a negative evaluation. The absence of amplifying reports after the initial contact report was made at 0810 June 4th, the time difference here due to the ships recording their logs based on a different time zone to where the battle was actually fought, might have been disastrous to our forces. Lack of amplification of contacts and failure of Midway-based planes to provide continuous tactical scouting on June 4th and June 5th probably prevented complete destruction of enemy forces. B. From the initial contact with the major Japanese force at about 1200 Thursday, June 4th, and during subsequent air attacks on their dispersed forces, again, slightly different time zones being specified here, no aircraft of our own forces were observed at any time in the immediate vicinity of these Japanese forces, except our own carrier-based aircraft. It is therefore the considered opinion of the commanding officer that all damage to enemy forces reported herein was imposed by the air groups of Task Forces 16 and 17. C. Material, planes. The disastrous loss of our TBDs needs no further comment. It is earnestly hoped that steps will be taken to provide TBFs for all carrier air groups immediately. The SBD is now obsolescent due to its slow speed. Our fighters, F4, F4s, are completely outclassed by Japanese Zero fighters in speed, climb and manoeuvrability. It is recommended that immediate action be taken to remedy this inferiority. D. Fighter escort. The need for adequate fighter escort on every attack mission cannot be overemphasized. Without this support, our attack groups are completely at the mercy of Japanese Zero fighters, as demonstrated in the initial engagement of June 4th. Adequate support implies not only fighters in sufficient numbers, but fighters at least equal to the enemy. Conclusion. Enterprise Air Group, both pilots and gunners, displayed a spirit of utter fearlessness, resolution, and determination throughout all air actions. This spirit, though shared by pilots and gunners alike, found its highest expression in the person of the Air Group Commander, Lieutenant Commander C.W. McCluskey, Jr., U.S. Navy. On June 4th, prior to intercepting the main enemy forces, it was his decision, and his decision alone, that made the attack possible, which led to the destruction of a major part of the enemy forces. It is the considered opinion of the commanding officer that the success of our forces hinged upon this attack. Any other action on the part of Lieutenant Commander McCluskey would inevitably have led to irreparable loss to our forces. The entire Enterprise Air Group merits the highest praise and commendation for a hazardous job well done. In separate correspondence, recommendation for awards and citations will be submitted. So there you can see the opinion of Enterprise herself as to the strengths and weaknesses of her air group. Of course, many will defend the reputation of the F4F4 against the Zero, but suffice to say at the time, the US pilots were not particularly happy with the matchup. Enterprise now headed back to Pearl to restock, rearm, and in the case of part of her air group, rebuild. VF6 was further enlarged to contain no less than 36 F4F4s, while VT6, or what was left of it, was taken offline for rebuilding. Instead, VT3 from the Saratoga was taken aboard with 15 brand new TBF Avengers. Although the older carrier was just coming back into action herself, she in turn was carrying a very mixed air group made up of her own scouting and dive bombing units, VB3 and VS3, but she was carrying VF5, Yorktown's fighter squadron, and VT8, the rebuilding torpedo bomber squadron that had been previously assigned to Hornet. Ashore, on Ford Island, were a mere 5 Devastators, one each from Hornet and Yorktown's air groups, and 3 from Enterprise. These were all that was left of the more than 36 Devastators that had left Pearl Harbor some weeks earlier. Weirdly enough, aircraft number 7 from each unit had somehow conspired to survive. Enterprise would also have a new captain, a new XO, and a new commander of the air group, Captain Murray being replaced by Captain Davis, as Murray had been made Rear Admiral in charge of Carrier Division 3, and Rear Admirals did not command a single carrier. Meanwhile, ashore, while waiting to receive new pilots and aircraft, Enterprise's air group ended up being involved in a huge brawl that erupted when some B-17 pilots began loudly claiming credit for some of the Japanese carriers at Midway. Needless to say, this went down about as well as that time when Klingons insulted a much later Enterprise in front of her chief engineer. One of VS6's pilots, A man large enough that other men looked on in wonder every time he squeezed himself into a cockpit, stood up, walked over, and promptly knocked one of the B-17 pilots clear off his stool with a good old southern haymaker. The bar then erupted, and it would take Shore Patrol no less than 20 minutes to finally gain the upper hand over the swarming carrier airmen. Many of the more experienced surviving pilots were also due to leave the ship. Handed 30-day leave passes and sent back to the continental United States, they were to form either the nucleus of new air groups who were training up back home, or else to help rebuild shattered existing units. By mid-July, Enterprise was judged ready for sea, and with her significantly refreshed air groups, she headed out with a new admiral in charge of her task force, Rear Admiral Thomas Kincaid. She also had some shiny new escorts, the battleship USS North Carolina and the small cruiser Atlanta. On the voyage back to the front lines, she now fell in with the Saratoga and the newly arrived USS Wasp. Then came troop transports loaded with Marines. It was clear that her new mission was not going to be just another raid. This was something substantial. In fact, it was the start of Operation Watchtower, which would turn into the Guadalcanal campaign.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.